This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the Pentagon are digging up the remains of hundreds of service members from the Korean War. It's part of a massive identification project. Those war dead are being considered or had been considered unknown. But developments in DNA and forensic technology have given scientists new tools, and it's also giving families new hope. WUNC military reporter Jay Price traveled to Honolulu, where the disinterment operation is taking place. He joins me now. Welcome back, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Tell us more about what was going on at this site in Honolulu.
Well, I mean, for starters, we'll set the scene a little. It's called the cemetery is called the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, and it's just this extraordinary place. It's set inside a volcanic crater above Honolulu, like right on the edge of the city. It's referred to as the Punch Bowl because of its shape locally. And it's right on the edge of the city, but the walls of the crater just shut out Honolulu. The views, the city sounds and all that. There's no sense of being in the city. It's just this kind of wonderful, huge amphitheater-shaped place that feels like a park with tropical flowers just falling from trees onto the graves. And it's actually a pretty big tourist attraction for good reason, but just an extraordinary place.
And a big cemetery.
Yeah. There's more than 50,000 people interred there, and it's just, it's big. It was created after World War II to offer a resting place to those who were killed in Pacific fighting. And despite the exotic location, it works like any other national cemetery run by the VA, like Arlington. So you have these unknowns from Korea and unknowns from the Pearl Harbor attack, for instance, but you also have a lot of veterans who, in many cases, were recent burials and their dependents, and their columbaria for cremated remains. But, you know, these kind of flat, set into the ground gravestones, there's nothing above ground. So it just looks like this beautiful park. But it's an incredible setting to be buried in.
And all of those who are buried there are not unknown. There are some identified.
Right? Yes, but the vast majority.
Well, let's talk about the 650-plus bodies or the remains of those bodies that are now being disinterred in order to identify them. They had pretty much lost hope that they would ever identify those.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of implicit in I think a lot of in the way that a lot of people think about that term unknown. You know, this kind of hopelessness. Well, we just call them unknowns and walk away from it. We honor them to a great degree. There's the Tomb of the Unknowns, which, you know, really important kind of symbolic place at Arlington, is celebrated greatly in kind of national history and lore. But it has that tinge of hopelessness as well as the honor. And, you know, to be honest, this project, I think, means that essentially the entire meaning of that term unknown has flipped from something that was kind of hopeless to these people can likely be identified.
Well, let's tell us what has changed.
Well, after years and years of kind of honing and improving the skills that it takes to identify the long buried dead and development of some new approaches, the military agency tasked with identifying the folks that were lost at war and recovering some in the field determined there was a better than 50% chance. They now have the technology, but determined there's a better than 50% chance of identifying these remains. So it went through all of the bureaucracy to get the approvals. This is a huge bureaucratic thing. It's not a small thing to dig up even one person. But 652, they had approvals from the state of Hawaii. They had to get help from the VA, which controls the cemetery. The VA had to allocate people to dig them up, you know. And it's a unique process. Nothing like this has ever been done. The Pentagon's efforts to recover and identify remains were set up in the 70s in response to political pressure from the Vietnam War POW/MIA activists. And for decades, it focused greatly on recovery operations, these kind of elaborate and expensive expeditions looking for the missing in specific locations, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, India, Europe, the Pacific. And so it took this technology, but it also took this kind of sea change in bureaucracy to start thinking, oh, you know, we can keep doing the recoveries, but we can really, really bring up a lot of people here and identify a lot of folks if we can figure out how to do all of this and get a lot of answers for the families. So, you know, for a long time, they were identifying pretty small numbers for decades, you know, just a few dozen a year. But now they've developed this science to allow better chances of identification, and they've shifted their focus. to disinter months, which, you know, will yield hundreds of identifications.
And you talked to Emily Wilson, who is a forensic anthropologist in an identification lab.
Normally what you're looking at is variation. So I'm comparing hands. Everybody's hand is different, but it has the same five fingers, you know, thumb. It's all same, but it looks a little different on everybody. You could tell the difference between everybody's hand. This, somebody has an extra finger.
Forensic anthropologist Emily Wilson working to identify the remains of unknown soldiers from the Korean War buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. WNC military reporter Jay Price is with me. And, of course, they had relied mostly on various kinds of evidence, radiological, I would guess, looking at X-rays and whatever we knew about dental. But now DNA technology has taken them the next step. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, they rely on a lot of, and traditionally have relied on a lot of different sources of information. The size, the length of bones can help them determine if they've got a group of commingled remains. You know, they know how tall someone is, and they can kind of project from, say, their leg bones. But they've gotten better, and they've gotten kind of more recognized for their talents and identifying people from the markings, the very subtle markings on their bones, and what she's and from the shape of bones. They can be like fingerprints. And what she's talking about there isn't so much a sixth finger, but she was speaking metaphorically. I was there the second week they had for the second group of eight remains they had brought up. They're bringing up eight at a time. Every 2 weeks to help with kind of the flow of incoming cases so they can deal with the sheer volume of this. And I timed it so that I was there when they exhumed the second eight. I wanted to see the process of the exhumation, but also to talk with them about the first eight after they had a little time to start working and know what they were dealing with. They'd already identified two. This is a big deal. You know, they used to identify 12, 15, 30 a year. They already identified two in 2 weeks. And she was talking about this one set of remains she had laid out in front of her that had an extra bone in the neck. It's rare, but not unheard of, kind of a small extra rib attached to one of the vertebrae. They could have used the other bones to identify them, probably, but this made it really super easy. It was like having a sixth finger, essentially, for them. And they just kind of, oh, this is a no-brainer. So you got two sets of people helping with the identification. You have the forensic anthropologists in the lab looking at the bones, kind of using these techniques, and also, you know, dental folks there to help with, you know, dental x-rays and so forth and how that works out. But you also have the military DNA lab in Delaware kind of working the DNA side of it. And so the first eight they picked because they knew when they were put in the ground that they had X number of bones and they were probably something that could identify from bones. The second group, they thought maybe they would have to lean more heavily on DNA. It just helps with this kind of production flow. You have to think of this as this terrible, almost like a factory production problem they've got. They're dealing with all these remains. But she was talking specifically about that extra bone.
All right, let's talk about how important this is to the families. You spoke with family members and loved ones. Let's listen to the wife of Kenneth Reese.
I was 16. He was 19 when we got married. And we only lived together a week. They took him away. I can see him at the end of that train. He was on the train. And he was running back towards the back door of the train. And I could see him in there till the train was out of sight.
Christine Porter, the wife of Corporal Kenneth Reese, who fought and died during the Korean War. I'm talking to Jay Price. That was the last she'd seen him. He didn't come home, and he'd never been identified until now. This had to be very important.
Well, he still hasn't, you know, but I went and talked to her because she's among the thousands and thousands of people that could benefit from this. And this is why the speed with which the lab is working now is so important. These guys essentially have very, very little value if they identify them 100 years from now or 50 or 20 years from now. She's in her 80s. She has chronic lung disease. She's a wonderful woman. She may not be with us very much longer. She wants to know. They were only married a week, and of course it's weighed on her for decades and decades. And there are thousands of people out there just like her. There are more than 8,000 people missing in Korea. His name was on a manifest that North Korea provided when it returned some sets of remains after the war, these things later proved to be highly inaccurate. However, it's pretty suspicious. They don't just include a name for random reasons. And so you have all of these unknown remains, and you have some names, some records, and they use that a little bit to help with the IDs.
Let's talk about the DNA part of this. It's one thing to be able to identify the DNA or at least take it and get a good understanding of what you're looking at. But then you have to match it. How do they do the matching?
Yeah, I mean, and it works the same with the bones. They have essentially two libraries of material to help them do this matching. They have meticulously over the years built up a library of reference samples from the families of 92% of the Korean War missing to match the DNA against. It took a long time. It's a really, really important tool. And likewise, they now have a set, they thought they lost them in a big fire in St. Louis of military records. But a couple of years ago, they found a cache of chest x-rays of almost all of the missing, I think about 7,000 of them. So they have these kind of two reference libraries of material to compare with the remains that they find to help with the IDs. This is why this is possible now.
Possible and very important to the families. We will stay tuned. WNC's military reporter Jay Price, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, friend.
You can find a link to Jay's reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, North Carolina just elected 7 new black sheriffs. Is it part of the blue wave? What else is going on? We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us.